Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're going to be talking about our second Shocktober feature, Green Room, starring Anton Yelchin and Sir Patrick Stewart.
Names you should know.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
But before we get into that, let's talk about a little bit of news. Yeah, kind of an extension of what we were talking about last week. Last week we were talking about Kemp Powers' story on the Moth. Kemp Powers being one of the writers on Star Trek Discovery. I kept on waiting for this thing to show up on their website, and it wasn't until after we released the episode that I was like, wait a minute. And I remembered how, like, television and stuff and radio apparently works, and there is such a thing as reruns. And this was actually a rerun from, like, 3 years ago. And the story was up on their website all along.
There you go. Well, you know what? It was news to me, and it was news to at least somebody in the audience. So I say that it's still news.
There you go. It's like those old like NBC ads where they're like, this week, Mad About You is a rerun. But if you haven't seen it, it's new to you, right?
That's right. Exactly right.
Yeah, so it's up there. If you look, you can do like searches. You can do searches by the storyteller or whatever. And I believe it's called Where'd the Apple Go? Which is another reason why I didn't quite pick up on it, because I was like, wait a minute, there's no apples in this story. But they're referring to the Big Apple. Get it?
Ah, clever.
Yeah.
Very clever.
But regardless of that, it's up there. Go check it out. It's well worth listening to. Now, something which is brand new, which I know for sure, is another work by Kemp Powers, and that's One Night in Miami, his play, which, granted, the play has been out for years, but it's just now, this week, premiering in London, and to coincide with that performance or that run, they have released the script for the play online. You can get it on Amazon for the Kindle and everything.
Yeah.
And this is really exciting because this seems to be like the thing which he's sort of best known for, and it's, you know, a clear-cut example of you know, like narrative storytelling, you know, fictional narrative, you know, in a sense, or historical fiction or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's up there and I read it. And it's freaking awesome. That's all I'll say for now.
Yeah, because I have not read it as of yet. I will be reading it shortly, but I look forward to. It's been a long time since I've read a play. But I look forward to it. I mean, it's gonna be fun. Not fun, but it'll be nice to get back to reading a play. Something I used to do pretty regularly. And so I look forward to reading it.
It is fun. Yeah.
Cool.
And now I really want to see it. But, you know, we won't really talk about that much right now because we plan on covering it on this show thoroughly.
Yes.
After Shocktober.
Yes. All good things in time.
Mm-hmm. So if you want to be prepared, go pick up your copy now. It's called One Night in Miami. I think it's only available digitally, but yeah, check it out. It's well worth it. Very quick read. I'm an extremely slow reader, and I read it in like an hour and a half. So there you go.
There you go. Awesome.
Okay, so Green Room.
Yeah, Green Room. What can be said about it? The thriller that sadly is going to stand as you know, one of the final works of Anton Yelchin, and got a lot of critical praise when it was released. And has been warmly received by those who have seen it. Didn't do a lot of box office business. I don't think it even made its money back, at least not domestically. I have yet to run across anybody who has not dug this movie. And if anybody's unfamiliar with it, Anton Yelchin is the member of a punk band that's on Hard Times. And naturally, as these things happen, especially in horror thriller movies, one thing leads to another. They find themselves playing in a club full of people that they wouldn't necessarily be friends with. And as their show wraps up and they're desperate to get out of Dodge in the first place, somebody forgets a phone, somebody turns around to get the phone, and they witness something they shouldn't have seen. And that is basically what really gets the tension kicked off.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I mean, you were saying that it wasn't extremely successful financially, you know, or anything like that. And I guess that's true, but at the same time, it seems like, you know, the places that did play it were very successful with it. I mean, I told this story before, but the Music Box here in Chicago was playing it, and they had it forever. I kept on going to see other movies at the Music Box, you know, like whether it was like retro movies or whatever. And because of that, you know, like I felt like this happened at least three times, probably more than that. I was sitting in the lobby waiting for Green Room to end, you know? So like I heard like the last few minutes of the movie along with the theme song from, you know, outside some pretty thin doors three times, you know, and I always wanted to see it. It was just one of those things where I'm like, I'll get around to it. And I never got around to it. But they had it for a really long time, and it was playing in their big theater. So that, you know, kind of signals some success, because that's a theater where, you know, their movies are in and out like that, because they've only got two theaters and they've got a lot of stuff that they play. So that's pretty impressive.
Well, yeah, no, I'm glad to hear that it had, you know, sort of a local. Is it a movie that's a victim of, the current taste for horror films is possession movies and jump scares, and this movie has neither of those things. This movie is straight up just a thriller. It is people in a difficult situation, horrible things happening, and them trying to get out, and you sitting there the whole time waiting for them to get out. And I mean, maybe that's why it has trouble finding, as large an audience as it deserves. But in all honesty, my reaction after watching it was akin to when I watched 10 Cloverfield Lane. And at the end of that, I was like, "What? Why did I wait so long to watch this? This was really good." You know, spoilers on my review of it. It was very much a sense of why didn't I go to go catch this? Anton Yelchin gives a really solid performance. I mean, everybody does. I don't think there's a bad performance in this movie. Not a single one.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that you should bring up 10 Cloverfield Lane, because a lot of people have made the comparison between those two movies and a third movie which has come out recently called Don't Breathe, which is also extremely critically acclaimed, you know, especially for a horror movie. And all of those movies share kind of like a similar premise, in that it's like the protagonist is sort of like trapped inside of a building or of some sort against their will, and they need to try to find a way of getting out without getting killed by the people who are holding them captive, you know?
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I mean, like, comparing it to other horror movies, I don't know, in order to try to figure out like why it's not doing well, I don't think that most people going into it really were considering it as like a horror movie, you know?
But I'd say that's fair.
But I think like maybe if people had, they'd be more, because I mean, like, one thing that you always hear is like it's really intense, it's really rough, you know, it's very, very graphic in terms of its violence and everything.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
And I think that scared a lot of people who would normally go to see a movie like this away, whereas that's the type of thing which usually draws horror fans to stuff.
Yeah, I mean, but horror fans are very much, and I, you know, I came up as a horror fan. I loved slasher movies. Watched the heck out of them growing up. You know, the, you know, whether it was Freddy with his clever quips while he sliced and diced somebody, or Michael Myers, you know, dispassionately dispatching tons of people. People prefer a sort of, and I lack the words to really put this, what people are looking for in their horror movies, especially ones that have gore, is this sense that there's some sort of wit about the killer. And I don't mean wit in terms of intellect. I mean wit in terms of there's going to be something where you're going to maybe occasionally chuckle against your will or something like that. And there ain't none of that in this. Like, the stuff that happens is set in a real world where you see it and you, like, there's no escape from it. And, you know, I mentioned the, you know, coming up watching, you know, slasher flicks, because, you know, what movies like this often teach me, and I think I said this to you, I sent a message to you after I watched it, was for somebody who came up with slasher flicks, my tolerance for gore like this is alarmingly low. Like, there were two points where I actually looked away from the screen. Okay. And I was so into the movie that I couldn't take it, you know, and that is a hugely successful thriller in my book, because for me to be so invested in what's going on screen that I want to look away because I don't want to believe that it's real. That's awesome. That's good pull, you know?
Yeah. 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 You messaged me and you said something like, I realized watching this that my tolerance for gore is extremely low. And I'm like, I don't think that that's the case, you know, because, like, I think that if this were in, like, a Freddy movie or something like that, you'd be like, ah, ha, ha, you know, because it would be done with some sort of sense of humor, like you're saying.
Right.
But here, yeah, I mean, it definitely does, you're right, make it more real, and because of that, it makes it a lot harder to watch, you know? I just, before watching this, I went to a horror marathon and watched 5 horror movies in a row. And not once was I like, oh my God, you know, that's so gross or whatever. not a single time. And then, you know, seeing this, I was just, I had that same reaction that you did, you know?
Yeah.
And it really does, it really does speak to the effectiveness. And I mean, the intensity in this movie is just through the roof, you know? I mean, we're talking like Breaking Bad level intensity,
oh, yeah.
You know?
You know, and I'm glad you mentioned Breaking Bad, because I think that casting Sir Patrick Stewart in the role that he has acts the same way that when Bryan Cranston came into Breaking Bad, he was carrying this, you know, cachet from Malcolm in the Middle, where you didn't want, and they played with it. They knew that you were going to come in and see him in a certain way, and they were going to be able to subvert that. And I think that one of the greatest things about Stewart's performance and the way his character is structured in this is he's so matter of fact about it. I think it really contributes to the tension, because he's not maniacal. He's not delusional the way that maybe Goodman is in 10 Cloverfield Lane. He is simply doing this to these people because it's all strategic choices. It needs to happen this way because of this reason and that reason. And he doesn't care one whit what is happening to these people, so long as it is done in the proper manner, so that guilt can be, you know, taken away from his little skinhead club. And that's, I think, really contributes to the tension, because he doesn't have these big yelling moments. He doesn't have these big rage moments, or, you know, he doesn't flip out at any point. It's all businesslike with him. He is so calm. And I think that casting Stewart contributes to that, because he has that delivery. There's no, like, tortured explanation as to why he has a British accent or anything like that. He is simply there, and this is who he is, and you just go with it. So, I mean, casting Stewart wound up being a great move.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, the way that the character is written is really, really solid too. You know, I mean, it's really interesting. Like, there's one thing which I think really kind of stands out, as, and it's just a little thing, but it speaks so much to this character. You know, I mean, we're talking about, like, these people, they get caught up with this stuff and they end up in an environment which they are not at all comfortable with. They have to play a gig at this, I guess, what is it? It's like
it's a skinhead club.
It's a club.
It's a neo-Nazi. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, in the middle, it's a little converted warehouse out in the middle of the woods. I mean, it wouldn't even be converted because there was no way this was a functional warehouse.
Right.
But it's like this little concrete building in the middle of the woods. And you know that there's nothing positive about the place that you're going to. Like, this is the type of place where, like, if you're driving along, and I mean, I've been to places, I'm sure plenty of people, you've probably been to places where you turn in, you're like, okay, this is where we're, oh dear.
Yeah, no, I just I just had the experience when I was driving down to Atlanta and we went into a gas station and this other car pulled up and we're like, we need to get out of here now. We need to get out of here right now. And and this is that taken to an extreme. And, you know, I mean, it's really interesting, like in this one little character moment, because this environment is not at all, it's not like they're pretending to be something else or anything like that. Like,
right.
The thing is like wall to wall, you know, neo-Nazi propaganda, you know, with like swastikas and, you know, everything just like, you know, drawn
yes.
on the walls and everything like that. They are not hiding this at all, you know? And,
yeah.
and yet there's this moment where they're going in to, they're showing this band, their dressing room, and the manager or whoever says, just make sure you don't put any of your equipment in the hallway. That's a fire hazard. And the owner is really big on that. You know, he really doesn't want to break the fire code.
Yeah.
And that to me is just like, because, I mean, you start thinking about it and you're like, so like a fire marshal comes in here and does inspections,
right?
You know? And it's like, that's so weird, you know? But like, because there's a lot of illegal stuff going on in there, they do their best to, you know, not get Al Capone'd, as they said in some movie that I just watched recently. I don't even remember what, you know?
That's good, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that really does, and then when you know, you finally do see Patrick Stewart and he comes in, and there is equipment in the hallway, he's like, get this out of here, it's a fire hazard, you know? And I think that's, it just speaks so much to him, because like you're saying, he doesn't care about what happened. He doesn't care that there was a crime committed in here or anything like that, or he doesn't care about whether these people live or die. He cares about his business getting shut down, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah. Well, yeah. And what happens to kick it all off is, I mean, it's so horrifying, you know, that it's just, you know, there's even a sort of side plot, or, you know, not the proper term, but, you know, what happens isn't necessarily condoned by him. It happened without him knowing. And so he doesn't get mad about it. He just finds out and he goes, okay, well, we'll have to deal with that too. And it's just like, dude, like what you're doing right now is insane. Like how can reality be so warped for somebody that they don't see what they're doing is so completely wrong?
Yeah.
On every possible conceivable level. And I'm not even talking just about the guy's belief system. I'm talking about what he's doing during, you know, if anything, you're like, there's this weird disconnect with life that just, you know, is so, and the thing is, I'll give the, you know, I guess the production design or location scouting or whatever, the real credit here, because it really does speak, you know, where they are to that disconnect from reality. Because all of this is there, and this whole thing goes down in this secluded area in these beautiful woods, these just gorgeous woods where you'd maybe go hiking in the woods. You're not thinking that anything like this is happening. And so there's like a whole Texas Chainsaw Massacre aspect to it, too.
Yeah, I don't know about you. You when you're you know, rural communities in Washington, D.C. or whatever, but like we have a forest preserve down the street, and anytime like I walk down the paved path in that thing, I'm just assuming that I'm going to come across a building like this. I never think that a nice leisurely walk in the woods is going to lead to anything good.
Oh, city boy. City boy, city boy. Come on, man.
But yeah, I mean, you're totally right. I mean, he's basically, I mean, I guess he'd be like a sociopath, right? I mean,
yeah, I'd say he fits the bill.
Yeah.
Yeah. He checks off a couple of the boxes there.
So yeah, I mean, that sort of makes it all the more terrifying because there's no real reasoning with him or anything like that. He's just gonna do what he needs to do for himself, and that extends not only to these complete strangers to him, but also to the people who he knows and employs and hangs out with or whatever.
I will say that there was another, and you mentioned him earlier. I don't remember the character's name, but the one that tells him about the fire code, you stay with him through mm-hmm. the film, and he has a really interesting story through it as well. And I thought that was really well done, and I think that his performance makes his story feel so naturally a part of this. And I mean, the writing too, of course, but again, I keep going back to the performances. His was fantastic. And I mean, Yelchin is, there were people that said that this would have been a star-making turn for him. And I think that it definitely would have elevated him with casting directors. Because he's already been Chekhov, and he's already been in Running with Scissors, and he's been an Alpha Dog, and he's been in these great roles, and he's been acting since childhood. This is the type of movie where I could see a casting director seeing it and saying, oh, I could consider him for such and such. This is like a resume turner. Do you agree? I mean, that's how I saw it.
Yeah, in a sense. Before we get into Yelchin, just to go back to that other guy you were talking about.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Before this, I watched the director, Jeremy Saulnier's first movie, which was called Blue Ruin, because I had read that these were going to be the first two films in a color trilogy. Blue Ruin, Green Room, and then, but then I read something like an AMA that Saulnier did, and he's like, yeah, probably not. There's not probably going to be a color trilogy. But it is interesting in that, like Green Room, in addition to describing, the waiting area for a band, before they go on stage or whatever, the word green really does apply to this movie because the color palette is very, very green throughout.
Oh, yeah.
Whether you're outdoors in the woods or inside, with the lighting in the building or whatever, it's all very, very green.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Blue Ruin is similar. Like, I still don't know why it's called Blue Ruin. I mean, I don't know if that's a term. Okay. Is that a term? I don't know.
I don't know. If it is, I don't know what. Sure.
I mean, but aside from whatever reason, it's an extremely blue movie. Almost the entire movie has that. That's in the same way that Green Room is green, Blue Ruin is blue. But regardless of any of that. Oh, go ahead.
I mean, does Blue Ruin have the same cinematographer? Does he work with the same guy in both movies, or is this something where he shifted it because he wanted a different look?
No, I don't think that it does have the same cinematographer, because if I'm not mistaken, he shot Blue Ruin himself.
But
Blue Ruin, you can tell, is a much smaller budget and everything. But one of the interesting things about it is that guy who you're talking about, his name is Macon Blair. And he's the lead in Blue Ruin.
Oh, okay.
And the character is actually similar. They're very similar in a lot of ways. Not in terms of, like, he's not, a neo-Nazi by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah.
But just sort of like his outlook on the world and the way he sort of interacts with the people around him. It's kind of like that. In Green Room, just like kicked up to 11. But if you liked Green Room, check out Blue Ruin. It's not nearly as good as Green Room, but it is very good, and it is sort of very similar thematically, in a strange way. But
okay. Yeah, and that's on Amazon
Prime. Yeah, you can get it on Prime. Yeah, you can watch it for free if you have Prime. So definitely check it out.
Well, it's technically not free, Mike.
If you have Prime, it's free.
Yes. Well, I mean,
you pay.
Let's not quibble over business models, Mike. Let's stay focused on the movie.
Fair enough. But yeah, as far as Yelchin is concerned, I had heard a lot of the same things that you had heard, with this being sort of like a, a career-defining performance and everything, and sort of like pushing him to another level. And, you know, I mean, I thought that he was really good. I guess I wouldn't have necessarily considered that. I wouldn't have considered it to be like a standout performance in his career if people hadn't been saying that. Not that he's bad by any stretch of the imagination. I think he's consistently good. And I think that he's really good in this too. But, I mean, like, I wasn't expecting anything less from him.
Yeah, but what I, you know, and I'll say maybe it just has to do with the type of film that it is. Mm-hmm. But this is, in a sense to me, a return to Alpha Dog, where I forgot that I was watching an actor. Mm-hmm. I completely bought him through the whole thing. And as much as I love his performance as Chekhov, there's enough artifice about the last three Star Trek movies that, you know, I'm playing along as opposed to completely believing. Whereas when I watch this, and I mean, you know, we're singling Yelchin out for, you know, obvious reasons here, the Star Trek connection, everything. But, you know, this is true of a lot of the performances, you know, in this film. But with Yelchin, I forgot that I was watching an actor. He made me believe that I was watching a person having an experience. And, you know, Imogen Poots, she's terrific, too. And she helps with that. And it's very compelling as a result. But I think that's probably why people were, you know, pointing it out, because he goes from the, you know, these, you know, the big concern with every actor, you know, Harrison Ford and, you know, with Han Solo and everything like that. Like, it would be very easy to say, okay, well, now he's in the big blockbusters and he's just going to be in these big, highly produced, explosion-driven movies. And instead, this is that return to a smaller, convincing performance that just draws you in. And then at the end, you think, oh my gosh, that's right. That was Anton Yelchin.
Yeah. I wasn't like blown away by Yelchin. I mean, although I did think he was very good. But you know who really did sort of blow me away was Stewart.
Oh, Stewart. Yeah, Stewart was amazing.
Because
he was amazing.
We've all seen Stewart a billion times before in different roles. And he tends to gravitate towards, I think, that other type of stuff that, you know, we're talking about, the more, you know, X-Men and, you know, Star Trek and all that stuff.
Well, he knows to keep his checks, you know, from bouncing.
Yes,
for certain.
Exactly. Yeah. But seeing him here, I had never seen him in anything like this, and he really kind of blew me away. You know, I thought that he was outstanding in this.
I completely agree that he was outstanding, and, you know, we keep going on about the performances. I don't know the actor's name. But the guy who commits the crime, who turns around before he leaves the room, and he looks at Yelchin, and he has that brief conversation with him about, that was the song I did it to. That guy was straight up terrifying.
Yeah.
Like, terrifying on the level of, I thought that maybe they went and they got somebody from a club like this, and they're like, okay, just talk to him. And, you know, like, he sold that to me. Totally. And the thing is, I'd say I would point to that scene, the way that Yelchin played it, as, you know, part of what really sold his character as well, of that overwhelmed, like, not, you could see it spinning in his head. What do I say in response to him?
Mm-hmm.
What on earth can I say that doesn't get me killed, but doesn't condone what he has done at the same time?
Yeah. It's crazy. You know, I mean, there's so much tension in this movie from things like that. And, you know, those performances, they come from places that you wouldn't normally expect. Like, there's a guy, he's in this one, too. His name is Devin Rattray or Rattray. I don't know. But he's got a much bigger role in Blue Ruin, and he actually plays Macaulay Culkin's older brother in Home Alone.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And he's in both of these movies, and
you
see him,
wow,
and you're like, oh my god, what happened to, you know, it's like he's an adult now.
Butch, what happened?
Yeah, but his performance in especially Blue Ruin is just like, you know, just like that type of thing, you know, super realistic.
Yeah.
Like, this is a person, this is a real person who's doing these things, you know.
Yeah.
And it's kind of terrifying. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. On the whole, it's pretty great. It definitely has you on the edge of your seat the whole time,
yeah,
you know? And yeah, I mean, it's super intense, super intense.
Yeah, and the best part is that they remember the rule that you should have with thrillers and comedy. Keep it short.
Yep. Yeah,
they do not drag this out. They know how much an audience can take, and they give it to you. It's like an hour and 30-something minutes long,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't feel too short, and it thankfully doesn't feel too long, and it gets in, it does its job, and it gets done, and that, I think, is... You know, I give it high praise for that as well. So I highly recommend anybody go out. You got an hour and a half in your day or your evening or whatever. Go out and rent it and watch it. It's great.
Yeah, for sure. I'm totally in agreement with you about, you know, shorter movies and stuff like that. I mean, anytime someone says a movie's an hour and a half, I'm like, thank you. Thank you so much.
It depends on what they're trying to do. Depends on what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
I wouldn't expect Michael Mann to turn out an hour and a half movie.
No, but I think that, you know, it would be really cool if he did. I think he could, you know, and it would work perfectly.
Probably.
Well. Yeah.
Probably.
I don't know. But yeah. And Blue Ruin is also, it's only like an hour and a half long. So
cool.
Definitely check it out. Well, it's been fun talking about Green Room today. But that's not all we're talking about on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
I've seen some people panicking. Oh my God, the Andorians are now going to be purple and the Tellarites won't be pigs. They'll be aardvarks. You know,
no, that
whatever.
Would be great if they were aardvarks.
That would be Talaxian. Yeah.
Standard orbit.
My greatest joy is hearing from those fans who have read the book and said, I feel like I know him now. Thank you so much for that. I always thought he was a good man, but now I know he was a good man. And he was somebody to, you know, look for a role model and try to be that kind of a role model to other people.
Saturday Morning Trek.
I try to see it how a kid would see it when they were watching this for the first time in 1973. It's not that if the devil's not real, so God isn't real. It's, no, the devil's real, and he's actually kind of cool, and maybe we should help him out a little bit? That's the way I kind of think it. And I think that's even more transgressive than any sort of statement on whether or not the devil truly exists.
Melodic Treks.
Darlings, our new darling, our darling, our darling, Charlie is my darling, and I love that.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, hit that subscribe button. That helps us out a lot and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. But yeah. If you don't use Apple, you know, there's plenty of other places. I saw someone on the Babel conference saying, like, hey, I have Android. What do you guys use for your podcasts? Well, you can use Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, any of those things, you know?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we need to thank our associate producers, Jeff Sutter, Chris Steftenagel, and Norman C. Lau.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. We couldn't do it without you. And if you want to become an associate producer or just help us out with a donation, you can head on over to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And there you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the perks we have for you. So if you'd like to help us out, just head on over there and donate. That's patreon.com/trekfm, and we really appreciate the support. If you want to contact us, you can find us on Twitter at TrekFM, or you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Facebook is also where you'll find our listener forum, the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, look for Kessel Junkie on your social network of choice, and that's where I'll be. You can find me co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast, on the Nerd Party Network with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing. You can also find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig Sorrell, where we do zany and funny things every week. and otherwise just harassing Mike. But Mike, where can people discover you online?
Well, you can find me right here on Trek FM, producing From There to Here, our daily rewatch show where we look at all 729 episodes of Star Trek from beginning to end. And you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. All right. Well, that's it. We're halfway through Shocktober.
Oh, boo. I hate halfway through Shocktober. I wish we could start it again.
Boo. Like a ghost.
You're in the
Shocktober spirit, I can tell.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, next week we're going to be watching another spooky movie, this time from the showrunner of everybody's favorite season of Enterprise.
Yes.
Mr. Manny Coto, who wrote and directed next week's movie, Dr. Giggles.